So I guess we're right on the hour. I'll go ahead and mute out the lines. Al, can you still hear me?
I did. Yep. Gotcha.
Oh, fantastic. Well, first of all, thank you so much. We know you've got a very full and busy schedule, doing an amazing amount of travel. I think, what did you fly, like 150,000 kilometers last year or something like that? Some amazing amount.
Well, when
amount.
You live where
I know,
live, there's only one option.
I like that too, so I know how crazy that gets. So
the world doesn't come to me. I got to go to the world.
Yeah, I know exactly how it works. So, anyway, so welcome everybody, and we're very excited to have Alistair Gray on for our interview this evening. Let me introduce Alistair Gray for everybody. First of all, Alistair lives mostly in Sydney, Australia, but also in Auckland, New Zealand as well, Alistair?
No, I used to travel in and have a practice there, but these days just in Sydney.
Okay, just in Sydney. Anyway, but you do lecture at the Bay of Plenty College, which is in New Zealand, and the Wellington College of Homeopathy. And in Australia, I think you lecture at the Sydney College of Homeopathic Medicine and the Australian College of Natural Therapies and Nature Care College in Sydney. Al was also a regular seminar presenter in Kuala Lumpur for the Homeopathic Academy Council of Malaysia, and he holds their PC Home. Alistair has also regularly presented and lectured in Toronto, Canada, Boulder, Colorado, San Francisco, Galway, Ireland, Preston, and Nottingham, England, as well as Bangkok, Thailand. Al trained in the UK at the School of Homeopathy, where he completed his postgraduate work at the Dynamis School in London. And in addition, Al has really pioneered a commitment to quality research in homeopathy, and he's conducted a number of really excellent provings, including the white-tailed spider, the box jellyfish, the Moreton Bay fig, the tea tree, licorice, cockroach, toad, seahorse, cactus, and many, many others. He runs and teaches the Residential Fusion Sessions, a postgraduate program in homeopathy offered in New Zealand and Australia. And also, Al is the writer of a number of books, plus your most recent book on case-taking, which is really just an excellent overview of the whole the different approaches and methods throughout the history of homeopathy in terms of this very all-important aspect of the science and art of homeopathy. So on top of all of that, being an excellent homeopathic practitioner, prover, and lecturer, Al is just a wonderfully nice human being and somebody I'm really happy to be able to call a friend and colleague. So again, thank you so much for joining us on the call this evening.
No problem at all.
Yeah. So for those of you who are not aware, Al will be one of a number of top-level speakers who will be presenting at this year's upcoming National Center of Homeopathy Conference, which will be running from April 8th through the 10th, and will include various speakers like Al, George Vitolkis, Jeremy Scher, Mahmoud Mangiavori, Will Taylor, Annette Snivellet, Anna Vivaca, Miranda Castro, and many, many others. It's really a star-studded lineup of speakers. Also, there is a special deal for people who register for the conference before January 28th. You can actually get a free gift of a $400 audio course to choose from. There are three different courses, one on new, old, and forgotten remedies, one on the homeopathic treatment of mental and emotional disorders, and one on snake remedies. These are audio courses. They have a retail value of $400. And for those people who register before the January 28th deadline, they actually get a free copy of this $400 course. So if you want more information about that, you can visit the National Center of Homeopathy website at www.homeopathic, that's homeopathic.org. And then if you go to that home page and you look on the left-hand side, you'll see the link for the conference page. All right, well, with that quick introduction, I know, Al, that the topic that you're going to be presenting on at the National Center of Homeopathy Conference is the treatment and management of drug and alcohol issues with homeopathic medicine. And I'm curious, how did you get interested and specifically busy in this particular kind of work?
Yeah, I was wondering the same thing, and I think the answer is like most things in life, you fall into it and then realize, how the hell did that happen? And I suppose really, when I moved to Australia 15 years ago, I ended up setting up my practice in a part of Sydney that just seemed to lend itself to people with disposable income and just a little edgy. I think it's even probably every large city has its equivalent. And in the Sydney context, it was this suburb called Glebe. Lots of young professionals, disposable income, hippies, a couple of natural therapies, colleges as well were there. And just suddenly realized that people were saying things to me in the consultation that I had just not heard when I was practicing in England. And in a smaller city, more rural or regional areas. And so it just happened that way. And I suppose a couple of other things really started to get me thinking about what was going on. And I realized that if sometimes the people that were sitting in front of me talking about their addiction to chocolate or salt or coffee were often saying essentially the same things to me as the people that were wrestling with cannabis or heroin or anything else. And it was those sort of striking parallels, really, that really started me really thinking about how homeopathy was going to be effective, how I was going to be effective, and try and unpack what I was doing, because I started to get some pretty good results. And I suppose really, it's the same for us all. It's when you listen to Jan Schulten or Rajan, or you listen to everyone else, we're trying to maximize our effectiveness. And I suppose through that process, trying to work out what it was that I was doing, either in terms of prescriptions or questioning, sometimes in terms of how I was being, that really got me orientated to thinking about this demographic in my practice. So I think over the years, the way that my practice has fallen is a little different to other homeopaths. I don't see that many kids in my practice, and I know that children make up the bulk of many, many, many homeopaths' practices. I got colleagues in Sydney that, that's 80% mums and kids, and if I get one or two, I usually just refer them because some other folks do a much better job. But I end up with lots of patients presenting with anxieties, male patients, patients with and this area that I'm speaking about now, people that are wrestling with issues of drugs and alcohol on top of perhaps their presenting symptoms. There's one other thing that, as I was reflecting on this topic and what I was going to be saying to you, I had a couple of really interesting experiences. When you look back at your practice over the years, you realize that there are some key patients that teach you something as a practitioner. And I think that in this instance, there are some patients that taught me a lot and have really formulated or helped form my approach to some things. I treated two sisters more than 10 years ago. And if I can just indulge and talk you through. Yeah, just because they're pretty interesting cases. The first sister came to see me. She was heading off on a trip to India, I think, to do a little bit of self-exploration, but also to do some acting work. And I think was moving on to Europe soon afterwards. And she came in actually to the clinic to buy a first aid kit just to help her on a journey with a bit of, perhaps some travel sickness or whatever might happen in the Indian context. But nevertheless, we got talking, and soon after, an hour went past and we were well into the middle of the chronic case. And the symptoms that I remember very clearly were that she was, at age 12, the number one, the best swimmer in Australia. She was the top. She was the best. And her teenage years were characterized by a real decline in with her relationships with her parents, eventually starting to experiment with recreational drugs and alcohol, and ended up addicted to heroin, working and living on the streets, and doing some sex work as well in Sydney. All of those things came together, did a bit of repertory work, and I sent her off with a dose of platina. And as I recall, I think the dose...
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the remedy. Could you say it again?
Platina.
Yeah, platina, okay.
Mm-mm-mm. And I'm not sure what the potency was at the time, but probably something like a 1M. And I remember an email that I got 6 weeks later from her, and there were a whole lot of swear words in the email, but which I won't go into. But essentially, the gist of it was, what have you done to me? I don't know if you've ever had one of those emails. Her job before she left was running events, and there's a large gay and lesbian community in Sydney, and she was running the Mardi Gras. And basically, the job description meant that, you know, you either had to be gay or lesbian. Anyway, so I got this email back from her. It said, what have you done to me? And I ignored it. And then later, 6 months later, she came back and had one of these life-transforming experiences from homeopathy. Basically, she was heavily pregnant in a relationship with a lovely bloke, and her life, you know, really, really changed and transformed. And, you know, one of the strong features of that was that homeopathic intervention. Soon afterwards, she sent her sister to see me, and her sister's story was just exactly the same. Age 13, the best swimmer in Australia, the top, the best, and a decline in her teenage years with a whole lot of rebelliousness into these behaviours, exactly the same. The difference was, and I remember thinking in that consultation, well, obviously I'm just going to be doing one of these other, you know, very, very accurate, nice, tight prescriptions and hopefully getting a similar result. But what actually happened was I couldn't get any clear characteristic symptoms from her at all. While I got a whole lot of story, I didn't have anything to work with. And it's really interesting that over the next two or three years, I saw her regularly in my clinic, just on an ongoing basis. And my approach with her was utterly different. I remember lots and lots of prescriptions of Lycopodium 6 or Nux Vomica 12 as she was really, really wrestling with some of the side effects of heroin and methadone. In other words, I had to absolutely change my approach with her to get any to make any headway at all. Lots and lots of organ prescriptions, low potencies, repeated doses, and eventually the thing that really assisted and pushed her through and got her into a really, really lovely, healthy state was germanium, prescriptions of over a period of time of germanium. So I suppose the reason I'm telling you that is that one of the formative experiences I've had in wrestling with this demographic, I suppose, or this piece of my slice of my practice, is that my approach has had to change and adapt over time. Lots of compliance issues, lots and lots of attempts at really getting to the center of the case, but not really getting there, and having to fall back on other methods and other strategies to make any headway. So I think those would be the bullet points, really, about how I started to get into, working with folks that are wrestling with these issues.
Al, you mentioned compliance, and that's obviously an issue that's a big one when dealing with this group of patients. Can you tell us a little bit about how you address this particular issue?
Well, yeah, I can. I suppose that I long ago in my own practice, and I suppose again just simply because of where I am and the type of practice I have, I just let go a long time ago the idea that my patients are going to be compliant with what I want. You know, and it's a funny old thing that in homeopathy we've got these strange little rituals. You know, we've got, if we're prescribing a 50 millesimal potency, you know, it's take your remedy and put a few drops in water and stand on one leg and turn to the east and, you know, whatever your instructions are. And I just wonder the degree to which we overcomplicate homeopathy and we expect expect our patients to comply with us. You look at some websites of some of the more prominent homeopaths out there and what they say about homeopathy and all of the things that patients should do. You look at the literature that we've got in homeopathy, like even Vithulkas or Stuart Close, and definitely Kent going back. And they've got really, really strict guidelines about how our patients should behave when they're coming to see us. You know, stop doing this, go over there, do this, you know. And I really don't think it lends itself to a contemporary context, or especially it just simply hasn't really worked in my situation. So in terms of compliance, I expect that my patients... let me just say that differently, because as long as we're clear, we're talking about this percentage of my practice. I don't expect or even anticipate compliance, so I make it as easy as possible in terms of delivering the medicine. I don't have any... I don't do the here's one pill, come and see me in 3 weeks, any of that stuff. I make the process as easy as possible and as unintimidating as possible as well to anyone that comes to see me. So therefore we've got a problem, because if you're anticipating or not getting good compliance from a patient, you'll know, Kim, from your travels around the world, that people, that homeopaths go two ways with that issue. They either say, oh, okay, if I'm only going to get one shot at this person because they're not compliant, then I've got to get it right, and I've got to get it right the first time. Mm. I don't do that. And what I've noticed with generations of students that I've been involved in teaching, and now that I've got this role at Endeavour College of Natural Health, where I'm really responsible for about 600 students at the moment, I've absolutely insist that they do not put that kind of pressure on themselves. And I think as a profession, we put far too much pressure on ourselves by attempting to get this perfect, you know, holy grail, golden bullet type of prescribing. I think the anxiety that creates is just too much pressure, too difficult. It's not that I don't aspire to it, it's that I don't necessarily think that this is the only way to go. So I go a different way, and if I, the only thing that I demand of myself when I sit down with my client is that I engage with them, and I make sure that they know that they've been heard. And it's really interesting, because two things happen when you do that, when you really, really engage with someone. Either they come back, and then you can work with them over time. Or the second thing is that that interaction speaks to a piece of them that they've forgotten. And it happens that I might see someone once, but then 18 months later, back they come. Yeah, and they remember something that they thought or that we talked about or was described in that consultation. And then when they're perhaps in a position to address some issues they didn't want to previously, then, you know, we can get into that. I suppose what I'm saying, therefore, is that the only thing that's really, really important, if compliance is not going to be an issue, is that you engage with your client as much as you're humanly, you know, as much as humanly possible. And then, of course, when it comes to the medicine or the remedy that you're going to be prescribing, well, when we're talking about people that are taking recreational drugs or drinking a lot of alcohol, then, you know, the only thing you can do is do your best. I remember a big deal in my development as a homeopath was needing to teach students the Organon. And you know, when you start to really get into the Organon, of course we do it when we're students, but really when you reread it and reread it and reread it 100 times, and then you've got to teach it, you know, bits of it really do get in. And I was astonished. I mean, it's probably obvious, really, but there's aphorisms in the middle of the hundreds. 162 to about 184 are just fantastic. I remember the impact that those aphorisms, when I really read them, had on me.
That's the method of homeopathy, is that whole little section in there, actually.
Well, exactly.
It really
what happened to homeopathy where the emphasis is when it went from managing a patient to finding this golden perfect remedy? And you know, those aphorisms are so amazing, where Hahnemann talks about, what do you do when you don't have enough medicines? Well, you do your best. That's what he says.
Yeah.
And you get there in the end.
I say, you know, 164 for me, Alistair, is such a critical aphorism. I always, you know, when I present cases, always look at that in terms of, you know, looking at the characteristic symptoms to guide yourself through the, as you said, the fact that we don't have a medicine that perfectly fits the patient's totality of characteristic symptoms. I mean, it's so critical to the actual practice of successful homeopathy.
That's exactly it. That's exactly the point. And then when it comes to the fact that either you don't have enough medicines or you've got a one-sided case or a case full of bland, non-characteristic symptoms, it's not that you, you know, give up and say homeopathy is no good. It's you do your best with what you've got.
Right.
And the crucial thing is that you've engaged the patient. And if you describe that as well, to your client, I think you start to get them on board. I look around at other healthcare professions, especially, say, in the Australian context. If we stick with complementary medicine, you've got, you know, your herbalists and your naturopaths and your chiropractors and your osteopaths, and they don't have this thing about the golden bullet. They have this thing about, I'm a health professional, and I'm going to apply best practice based on a whole lot of evidence that this intervention is going to be the best thing for you right now. I think it's really healthy. So I encourage my students, and really, you know, I've started to relax a bit, and a lot of the tension and anxiety went out of my practice when I realized that all I was being asked to do is do my best. And, of course, auxiliary symptoms will come up, and, you know, you get there, you zigzag your way to cure, so to speak. The other fantastic aphorism, really, that's made a lot of sense to me is 209. Mm. And that's really where Hahnemann talks very clearly about multiple conversations over time.
Mm.
And again, the point being, how on earth did we get from the clarity of 1810, 200 years ago, where the homeopath's job, or mission, however you want to put it, is to work with a patient with what you've got in front of you, using multiple antisoric remedies or multiple remedies over multiple conversations, well, that's clearly more than one. How do we get from that to this idea which is still there and still being pushed in homeopathy that you've got to get it right first time? Ah, oh, drives me insane, really. Anyway, so I think in terms of compliance, patients, you know, I sit there with them, we have a laugh, we talk, I break all of the case-taking rules usually. Often I have a chat about myself. You know, we gossip about, you know, what's going on, and you know, a lot of humor sometimes as well. There's always tears and laughter, and I don't know, just somehow over the years, these have been some of the ways that I've engaged with these people. You know, less compliant folks, and of course, if they don't come back or if we get some part of the way down the track, I don't beat myself up, and you know, go back to, you know, as some homeopaths do, go back to their previous roles or move on to something else.
Yeah.
I think, the tension's been taken out of it for me. Now, of course, I'll put a little disclaimer there, Ken, because I'm not saying this is any excuse for sloppiness or inaccuracies or laziness. It's just that I've taken the emphasis off the patient having to behave for me, and I have to get it right first time. I think for me it's a combination that just seems to work in some way.
Al, you know...
I'll tell you, just one of the corollary to that as well, Kim. One of the things that I have done, I was listening to your introduction, and I realized that really the biggest influence on my practice in the last 5 years wasn't discussed. And that really is that in 2006, I enrolled in the Masters of Science program at University of Central Lancashire, and graduated with that Masters in 2000 and, God, when was it? 8, maybe 9, I can't remember. It's a long time ago. It's a blur. That was a really important teaching experience for me, getting me familiar with the amazing amount of research that's out there actually in homeopathy. But the laziness that we have as a profession as well. I mean, there's a lot of opinion, a lot of hot air gets talked in our profession, but not a lot of facts sometimes and not a lot of evidence. Anyway, so we were encouraged to do these research projects, and one of the ones that I did, and forgive me if I've actually mentioned this before, but I remember very clearly that it had a big impact on me, and that was I just crunched the numbers. I pulled out all the files out of my filing cabinet, and I did an audit on my last 500 cases. And one of the things I learned in that in terms of results, I was doing okay. But the most important thing was I realized that 94% of my clients are doing something else in addition to getting homeopathy. Have I said that to you before? Have I mentioned
that? I don't remember that, but that's very interesting.
Well, it was a real shock to me because I was taught homeopathy as if it's the only intervention that's going on with a client. Yeah? And quite clearly in black and white in my own practice, I've got patients that are up the physiotherapist and down the road to the osteopath and over there to the health food store getting their supplements and all the rest of it. Now, that's across the board. Now, I can tell you right now that with the group that we're talking about today, with those folks that are wrestling with issues around drugs and alcohol, they're doing all sorts of things as well, and they see me as part of their team. They don't see me as Al the homeopath that's going to fix me up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really, really a fundamentally different way of approaching practice and actually teaching homeopathy as well, realizing that, you know, we're often in the context of a team as opposed to one-off health providers.
Interesting.
Mm-mm-mm. Sorry, you were going to...
No. I just said it. No, Al, this is very, very interesting. I'm curious, specifically for this group of patients, you know, the people who are abusing alcohol or, you know, recreational drugs or tobacco or any of these types of substances, are there specific clinical principles and approaches or strategies that you adopt to treat this group of patients? And also, what kind? You did mention something about that you're getting pretty good success. What kind of success actually are you seeing in your practice with this type of patient?
Well, I think there are three broad categories when it comes to alcohol and drugs. There are the folks that come in and say, please can you help me with this problem that I've got? Yeah, I'm on methadone, I'm on heroin, just as I mentioned before with the couple of cases. That was a presenting symptom for that second sister. She was on a methadone program and she needed to get off. So that's the first category. You know, can you help me with this, please? I come from a line of drinkers, and I really want to do something about it. Now, in that situation, I think we've probably all had that situation in practice where you listen, and if there are lovely characteristic symptoms in the case, you know, you'll get a good hit. And in my practice, for example, you know, I'm mindful of a client many years ago who was wrestling with her alcohol addiction. She just gave me the perfect sifalinum case. I gave it to her, high potency, not very often, maybe a couple of doses actually, and what a response. You know, and I remember her sitting there and saying, you know, what is it that you've given me? You know, your drops have made me not want to drink alcohol anymore.
Mm.
So, you know, I think we've all probably had that experience, and that keeps us going back. You know, that's the hole in one, or the, you know, as I said before, that golden bullet. But those are the folks who say, can you help me with this? And over the years, people have come saying, help me with my gambling problem, help me with my attachment to gin or beer or salt or dope or heroin, whatever it might be. Boys.
Right.
The other two categories, however, are more important, I think, because usually in the context that I work, people say, geez, you know, help me with this eczema I've got. And, you take the case and you do all of the, you know, the work you're supposed to do. We look for the complete symptom for the eczema or the hay fever or whatever it might be. And then, just towards the end, you say, is there anything else? And you realize that they're smoking dope every night to get to sleep or that they've got some sort of compulsive relationship with chocolate. And so, in other words, this is a totally different situation where you've got someone saying, help me with this presenting symptom, but by the way, I've got this lifestyle. And then of that category, there's another subcategory, and that's, well, then they say, and I'm not going to change my lifestyle. or they say, yeah, I'm actually really, really wanting to, stop smoking. And so, you know, then we've got some decisions to make. And of course, look, it really does depend on the clarity and characteristics of the case. But those are three broad categories. When it comes to the principles that I work with, I mean, there are some that I absolutely adhere to, and I'll run through them with you. The first is, of course, I'm always looking for that largest totality. As I said, you know, that that one hit, that the hole in one, the golden remedy. Nevertheless, if I feel like I'm not going to get it, then I fall back into a different position with my case taking. And the position, the clinical principle that I work with is simple. You work with what you've got. Yeah? And if the client picture is not developed sharply and clearly, then I'm not going to prescribe any remedy on what I think might be there. So what I do is I've borrowed heavily from other disciplines around homeopathy. I think we can learn a lot from drug and alcohol counseling. I certainly in my own practice work with those principles of harm minimization, encouraging people to work with or withdraw from those substances or behaviors that are the most harmful for them at the moment. But I'm completely happy to negotiate that. And if it's only possible for someone to, at the beginning of treatment, give up coffee but not smoking, then I'll work with that. I don't have an opinion about that. But I'll work with a principle of harm minimization. I'm also completely happy to look someone in the eye and say, stop this behavior. You know, and that's a different approach where, you know, as the primary healthcare provider, it's entirely within our job description to say, no more of this. We're appropriate. I don't know how you teach that, but I've had a couple of situations in my practice over the years where I've got better results because I've just grabbed the big stick and I've, you know, shaken it in the face of a patient, so you've got to stop doing this now. Other things that I do in terms of clinical principles, one of the great things that Jeremy Scher teaches is the idea of constricting and expanding the totality of symptoms that you see. And, of course, if you constrict the totality of symptoms for whatever reason in a case, very often you're left with a decision. Ooh, here's a person in front of me, and, you know, my prescription is going to be to provide relief for the side effect from that drug that they're taking. And that's obviously a very, very different approach to that broadest totality of symptom approach where, you know, you're looking at the patient in all of their, you know, in their true size. You know, I'm thinking more a style of case-taking sensation method like Divya or Rajan. But by constricting it in a situation like this and saying, do you know what, the only thing I know for sure is that they're on those medications there, that recreational drug there, and this lifestyle here, and the only thing that I can do right now is to prescribe Nux Vomica 6X 3 times a day to support them at the moment. And I'm entirely happy to do that. So that's really about constricting and expanding the totality of symptoms as appropriate, as I see it.
Interesting.
Now, that often lends itself to isopathic prescriptions. So in my dispensary, I've got, you know, everything gone. You know, from, herpes simplex 30 to prednisone to opium and cannabis and all the rest of it. You know, those isopathic prescriptions that we need to sometimes utilize when we've got very few other options to assist. So isopathic options, tautopathy, something that I sometimes fall back on if I can't see anything else in these situations. And the French, you know, that with their drainage strategies, you know, can be very, very useful sometimes as well. Some of those drainage ideas from those from the French homeopaths with those potencies, you know, 4, maybe 5C, 6, 7, 8, 9, 15C, low potencies, and often have sometimes been quite useful. I think the principle that I work with above everything else is engage. You know, make contact with that person. Make sure that they know that they've been heard. And then I suppose the style of questioning that I do use is important as well. So with, you know, I will dig around in people's, you know, history and their lives, especially when it comes to some sort of compulsive behavior. So, but I do it respectfully, I think, and with a bit of authenticity. But the questions are, some of the questions that you've got to start asking are things like, of course, well, when did you start smoking? Or when did you start using cannabis, for example? That might give you an idea of what was going on at the time. You know, what was happening for you at the time. But questions like, what happens for you when you don't use it? Or what happens for you when you don't have access to your cigarettes? What's going on in that moment? And that suddenly gives you an insight into, you know, really what is that uncompensated symptom? What does it do for you? What does that substance do for you? When you reach for chocolate and, you know, what's going on for you the moment that you reach for that chocolate? You know, that gives you an insight into really what's going on. Some of those questions, what happens if you can't afford or what happens if you don't have any chocolate, salt, gin, whatever the substance might be? What does it stop you from doing is a really good question as well. And then, of course, you get that the very interesting information. Well, if I don't have my coffee first thing in the morning, for example, then you've got a clear symptom. And the clear symptom underneath that is, well, I feel tired. And there's your symptom. If it's gin, if I don't have my gin and tonic in the afternoon, I have this symptom. If I feel agitated and I don't have my cigarette, then this happens. And right there, you've got, in that case-taking, you've got, in that moment, an opportunity to really explore what's going on, the reason that they reach for that substance. You see, people, you know, our patients are not silly, and human beings have been doing it for a squillion years. If there's a symptom, they reach for something to fill the gap or to cure the symptom. But, of course, they get the dose wrong. This is the point. So if someone is feeling a lack of love, they'll reach for chocolate. Well, often they do. They reach for chocolate. If someone's in pain, it makes sense to reach for heroin because, or an opiate or something, because it works. But the dose is wrong. See what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so you've got an opportunity really to explore the symptom. The actual behavior is not... let me say that again. The substance itself is important, but it's the reason that they're reaching for it that's really, really important. And so I think when you start scratching the surface and asking those questions, you start to hear, my life is painful, I'm boring, I'm abandoned. You know, you just start to get juicy characteristic symptoms, but you've really got to scratch the surface, yeah, to get there. So I suppose we were talking about that in the context of principles. I dig and I ask some pretty awkward questions, and I don't let go unless, you know, someone really is finding it uncomfortable. Another principle I work with is you've got to work with a lot of positive reinforcement. I think it's crucial. Somewhere in that patient's case, there will be a piece of health in their life somewhere. And you've got to focus on that, you know, give them positive reinforcement. Encourage them that even though there's this and this and this, there's 8 pizzas a day, 4 bottles of wine and whatever else it might be, that there is somewhere in that, in all of that morass, there will be something to focus on, some piece of health, and encouraging them to be able to work towards that. Very, very important. And then posology. I think in terms of posology, as a clinical principle, I'm more than comfortable to prescribe appropriately daily, twice a day, 3 times a day, where as I said, where appropriately, and with an appropriate potency scale as well. It just seems to me that in terms of compliance, it makes sense for people that are really wrestling with pain or some sort of compulsive behavior that they take their medicine as they would any other orthodox medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So once a day, twice a day, that kind of thing. It's makes a lot of sense. I use the Q potencies, the LM potencies a lot. Low X's a lot. I've got so much Kalyfos in my dispenser, it's ridiculous. Nux vomica, Kalyfos, Avena sativa. These types of prescriptions go out quite regularly with me to these folks. And I suppose the other clinical principle I work with is that, as we know from drug and alcohol theory or from the academic world, and even what we know from, say, Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, that at the core, people reach for substances when they're disconnected from themselves in some way, or they're disconnected from something. We can't always know what that something is. We often speculate, but there's always a disconnection there. And really the job in the case-taking and throughout the relationship as you go through the you know, those weeks and months of assisting your clients is to attempt to reconnect them to that thing that they've forgotten. Yeah, those are the principles I work with.
Fantastic. Al, you recently published a wonderful book, an overview of different case-taking methodologies.
Mm.
And you reviewed, you know, really historically the whole gambit of different approaches to this aspect of homeopathic medicine.
Yeah.
Is there do you use different approaches, an amalgam of different ideas? Do you use what Hahnemann describes in 82 through 104? What's your approach to this important aspect of homeopathic medicine?
Well, I think it's everything. I mean, I realized, you know, I don't know how to answer that question because it's so big. Look, I mean, in terms of writing that book, I wrote it because I've been teaching students for a decade and it was just begging to be written because of the confusion that modern homeopathic students experience and the mixed messages they get. You know, it's hilarious sometimes. You know, you will have experienced it as well. You're supervising a final year student or even a recent graduate, and they ask some outrageously inappropriate question, and you think, how on earth did you ask that? When where did that come from? And because you know it's. When you've done something 1,000 times, it becomes so easy. But of course, you can't necessarily teach that level of skill. So, I'll put it back in the context of your question. You said, "What do I do?" Well, look, it's simple. I mean, I follow Hahnemann when someone walks in, and those directives that Hahnemann gives us. And 83, 84, and through to 100, and the Organon, you know, still hold good for us for the most part. My own approach is that I always focus on the reason that they're there. You know, what are you here for today? Tell me about that. And I keep it really simple, and I don't act weird in my practice. And so I focus on good, what I would call good Burninghausen Hahnemannian prescribing, and that's, gee, what do you got? Tell me about that. You know, is there anything that makes it better or worse? Any concomitants, although I wouldn't use that word. And I just make sure that I've got a really good working totality of that complete symptom. And usually that takes, I don't know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour tops. In the process of that, you get a feel for your patient as well, and you start to get a feel for when their chronic disease started to flower and get out of control. And you know, quite often it's asking about the cause of the presenting symptom that gives you the insight into going further back into their case or further more deeply into their case. But when you look at our case-taking directives, and what some of the experts out in the homeopathic world say today and why students get so confused is because what is being taught these days in terms of case-taking has been borrowed from other disciplines and especially from the world, well, English homeopathy is very, very heavily influenced by the world of Jung, yeah, from psychotherapy, from the psychotherapy of the mid-1950s and borrowed heavily from other areas as well. And so the reason for writing the book was really just to get people clear about who said what and why. Yeah? And it's not about this is a right way or this is a wrong way, but getting students and homeopaths and especially homeopathic teachers clear about when you ask this question, this is who told you to ask this question and why. There's a third reason as well, I realize, and that's, to my mind, there's been three very strong trends in homeopathy in our 200-year history. The first one is the Hahnemannian thread, really, and with what we just said, you know, where he says, his directives on case-taking, aphorisms 83 on. Of course, really, things changed. And even Kent's directives when it comes to case-taking are not that different. You know, he emphasizes more mental and emotional symptoms, but really they're not that different. The next big thread or change of direction in homeopathy when it comes to case-taking is really the influence of psychotherapy into modern case-taking. Neuro-linguistic programming, the work of Jung, and you can see that in, for example, Sankaran's first book, The Spirit of Homeopathy, where he encourages people to look at the uncompensated state and the delusional and the delusions as such. There's a third trend, and it's a very recent one, and I'm totally fascinated by it. When I've talked about it recently at conferences, I've realized that I still haven't been able to articulate exactly what it is that I've been trying to say, so I'll do it. I'll try again now. It's what I call a person-centered approach. And people, and I use this approach absolutely where appropriate with my clients. The person-centered approach really comes from the work of Rogers in the psychotherapeutic world in the 1960s, 70s, 80s. And his approach was rather than doing something or analyzing, rather than analyzing your patient or doing something to them, the job of the therapist or the homeopath, in fact, is to be with them. And it's a totally different orientation when you think about it. In other words, what he's saying in the world of psychotherapy, but we can also think about it in the world of homeopathy, is that our job is not to prescribe for our patients first. Our job is to be with our patients first. So this is that person-centered approach. Now, it doesn't mean you need a whole lot of psychotherapy knowledge. That's the point. It just means that you can be a person-centered osteopath or a person-centered general practitioner or a person-centered whatever. But from his perspective, and this is what I was trying to write in the third part of my book, is that the person-centered homeopath is with the patient first. All they're doing is engaging. And that was my point about engaging with them before. You don't need to do anything. You just got to be with them. Yeah? Be with them, have them clear that you're there listening and acknowledging them. That doesn't matter if it's an adult or a kid or a cow or a chicken. You can be a person-centered homeopath. But do you see the difference?
Yeah.
You're a person first, you're a healthcare worker second, and you're a homeopath third. And the remedies come third with this approach. It's very interesting. And I think for those of us, and I'll absolutely put my hand up and put myself in this category, I'm not a technician when it comes to homeopathy. You know, my knowledge of Materia Medica is from the books, and I need to go and read the books to find that information. I don't have it available to me. You know, if I was an acupuncturist, then I would not be the perfect technician, you know, in terms of putting the needle in the body. But I'm a good listener. And I think what I've noticed over the years with the approach that I've got, say, with these folks that we're talking about today, drugs and alcohol, is that there's so much value in listening. And then the remedy comes next as a natural corollary to being understood. And, in fact, quite often finding that similimum is so much easier when you've put down your books and you don't look at the repertory when the patient's in the room and all of those things. You just sit there with them, listen to them, be with them, and then once they're gone or at least once the consultation's over, then you open up the books and remember you're a homeopath. Does that make sense?
Yeah, a lot of sense.
I'm still.
No, it makes a lot of sense.
As you can probably tell, I'm still.
I think
articulate it clearly.
Really excellent exposition, really. Al, I spent all night asking you questions, because I know there's some folks listening. I'd like to give some of the other people on the call an opportunity to ask.
Sure.
Oh, but before I do that, I just I thought perhaps you are going to be one of the speakers along with a number of other homeopaths: Jeremy Scherer, George Vitolkis, Anna Vravaka, Massimo Mangialavori, Will Taylor, Froke Master. We have a really incredible lineup of speakers for this.
It's going to be a big party.
Yeah, it's going to be
fantastic.
A fantastic conference. And I'm just curious, maybe you could tell people on the call right now, before we open up for them to ask some questions themselves, what people can hope to get from coming to your presentation on the homeopathic treatment of drug and alcohol issues.
Well, two things, I suppose, and it's there in the title. There's a whole lot of treatments that we can apply and methods of homeopathy we can apply with these folks that are in pain and wrestling with their compulsive behaviors. And so, all of these amazing organ prescriptions, I'm really, going to bring my my bag of tricks when it comes to this remedy for that. Don't forget this one here. Don't forget to read the work of Compton Burnett or the French drainage folks. So I'm going to come with techniques and a bag of tricks from that perspective. But then the other word that's in the title is the management as well, and I suppose that's really what I've emphasized today in our chat, is the management of the folks here. So we'll be talking about compliance, how do you wrestle with complicated, difficult people? How can we make ourselves more effective and manage our patients through? Really, we are more than just technical prescribers, as I said. And so, I think there'll be a lot of time. We'll get it's a nice amount of time that I've been given. So people will walk away having got those techniques for treatment and the discussion around the management of. Yeah.
Fantastic. Sounds wonderful. All right. So, for those people who don't know, the National Center of Homeopathy Conference will be from between April 8th through the 10th. If you want more information about that, you can visit the National Center of Homeopathy website at www.homeopathic, that's homeopathic.org. And if you go to that homepage, if you look on the left-hand side, you'll see the link to the homepage for the conference website. So with further ado, let me open up the lines. Are anybody on the call who'd like to ask Al Gray some questions about homeopathy? Go ahead. Hello? Anybody on there? Don't be shy.
All right.
Go ahead.
All right. This is Jennifer.
What's your name again, please?
Jennifer.
Say it a little bit louder. Candace, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Jennifer Ruby.
Jennifer. Hey, Jennifer. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so interested in your use of glandulars or organ tinctures and whatever. Expand on that a little bit.
Sure. I think I caught some of it. I think the question was
it's about
can you
organ
talk
prescribing.
A little about the organ prescribe
yeah.
organ
yeah.
prescriptions. Was that right, Kim?
Yes, that's correct.
Mm. Look, simply one of the most stunning homeopaths around was James Compton Burnett, English homeopath, died I think in about 1900. When he was alive and practicing, lots of controversy, because he seemed to be saying in his prescribing that the job of the homeopath was to focus on the organ. And I tell you what, read his books, just fantastic, stunning results by using all sorts of prescriptions orientated to the organ that was at the seat of the problem, the seat of the disease. Now, James Compton Burnett wrote lots and lots of books. Fundamentally, there's been various attempts if you like, modernizing his work. Another great little book is Ian Watson's book from 1991 called Guide to the Methodologies of Homeopathy, and there's a lovely chapter in there about his work. But fundamentally, prescriptions like Ceinophus when the problem is with the spleen, or Adonis for the heart, this kind of thing, Spongia and Cactus, for very specific problems with the heart. And when you read the work of Compton Burnett, you just realize that there are, where appropriate, and again, when that large symptom picture's not clear to you, it's entirely appropriate to prescribe Magmuir when it's the best match for that liver problem, or Lycopodium in an appropriate potency, or Chalidonium or Cardus when that problem really is with the liver. So there's so much reading there to do, and those remedies, they're just gold, absolute gold. Yeah.
Great.
My teeth on Burnett. I love him.
That's we got a comment there. Somebody loves James Compton Burnett, part of the Cooper Club. So we probably have time for about one more question. Does anybody else have a question they'd like to ask? Al Gray, calling all the way from Sydney, Australia. It's a golden opportunity to ask one of the most respected homeopaths in the entire community with a tremendous amount of clinical experience a question directly.
Well, I will jump in there.
Go ahead.
This is Susan from Maine.
Hi, Susan.
And I'd like to know, I think I'm probably could gauge the answer, but, you know, in addition to treating the addictions to recreational drugs, here in America we have the great problem of the addiction to prescription drugs, things that their allopathic doctors are prescribing, and many of my clients are on a long list of drugs. So we're prescribing with that, and I'm wondering, do you use the same approach when you come across that?
You're clairvoyant. Yes, of course. I do. I don't see them as any different, really. But of course, the impact of those allopathic medications after a period of time just has such a devastating effect on the organs of the body, also the vitality of the body. And we just know that these are complicated cases. These are issues that I don't believe that Hahnemann had to deal with 200 years ago, and probably not Kent, and probably not Vithulcus on his island in the Aegean, where his patients are, let's say, healthier, much healthier. But you and I, in the city, you're in Maine, I think I heard you say, but you and I are probably dealing with patients that are buckling under this impact of toxicity, and like at no other time in history. And we've got to, for homeopathy to remain effective, we've got to develop ways of working with these folks. Again, engaging with them firstly, educating them about what it is they're doing, reconnecting them to a piece of themselves that they've long forgotten. And then you've got options, and you've got clinical options by trying to get to the very center. And then you've got those clinical options of working with the side effects of the drugs, or even offering an alternative to the drug itself as a way to work with that client, and step by step by step by step, slowly over time, you know, chipping away at their chronic disease. So in other words, the quick answer is, yeah, I use the same principles with recreational or medical drugs with my clients.
Great. Well, I think we're right out of time now. Al, again, I want to thank you so much. It was a very interesting discussion on some very important facets of homeopathic practice. I personally am going to be excited to see your three-hour presentation in Alexandria, Virginia, right across from Washington, D.C., across the Potomac, this April 8th through the 10th, National Center of Homeopathy Conference, star-studded conference with a incredible lineup of speakers. I think it's a total of about, I don't know, 17 different speakers, including the introductory track. So it's going to be an amazing event. And again, if you sign up before January 28th, you can actually choose a $400 audio course just for attending probably one of the best homeopathy conferences that's ever happened in North America. So can everyone give North American thank you for calling all the way from Sydney, Australia to join us this evening?
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
thank
Allison.
Thank you very much.
That's great. It's a pleasure, and you can I'll let you go to your dinner and your glass of wine, but only one.
Okay. Thanks, Al. Have a good rest of your day.
All right.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, Jim.